This is Michael. You're listening to Models of Masters, and I'm so grateful you're here. I'm breaking down personal stories, learned wisdom, and pieces of insight I hope can help you along your journey. Head over to my website, michaelbecker.org, for much more. And with that, let's get right into the show. So when I was first getting started in entrepreneurship, I had lots of flaws, right? But I think my biggest one, my fatal flaw, was undoubtedly shiny object syndrome. I was always looking for the next best thing, and almost always I'd jump at it before finishing the thing that I was currently on. Maybe you can relate to this. And so my flaw wasn't necessarily leaving one vehicle or one business for another. It was trying to do a bunch of different businesses at once and seeing which one, quote unquote, hit, which would then determine the direction that I would go. Basically, I didn't want to put all my eggs in one basket, and I wanted to maximize my probability of success, which in my mind, I assumed would be the case the more things that I took on. That was mistake number one. Mistake number two was with individual projects. I wanted to try everything. I was tactically impatient. I would discover some new growth hack or see some influencer proclaiming to have the one thing that would finally get me to X dollars per month, and I'd drop everything else and pursue it. Needless to say, that did not work out very well. My first three businesses never took off, and that was a major reason why. But what I learned was valuable, and that was that the ventures didn't fail because I was inept as an entrepreneur or because I wasn't capable of success. It wasn't even that I had bad judgment. I did then and still do believe that my judgment is actually one of my strongest qualities. It wasn't an intellect thing. It was just a lack of unwavering commitment toward the direction that I'd chosen. And the character flaw that was underneath that, and I did a lot of inner work to reveal this, was just that I had a relatively weak sense of certainty in making committed decisions. In other words, low conviction. I would rationalize switching directions as trial and error, but really it was just fear of missing out on something that, in my mind, could get me better results quicker, which was totally false anyway. And I didn't get that repetition and duration would be required no matter which tactics that I chose, and that any tactics could and would be successful when both of those inputs were present. So I had to distinguish between fortitude, which I've always had, versus this pervasive deficiency of mislabeling distractions as opportunities. Underneath that was a lack of self-trust, and honestly, like a chemical thing too. I'd get a little dopamine spike when something new came across my desk. And as weird as it sounds, it like excited me to drop whatever I'd been doing for the prior 12 days to jump on this new arbitrage hack, thinking I'd just found something that the rest of the market wasn't yet privy to, and that my willingness to adopt it would somehow give me an edge. So what I was really doing was staying on this merry-go-round that wasn't actually getting me anywhere. I was just hopping on to new horses every so often for a different view. And that is when I learned. Once you commit to something, options become distractions, not opportunities. So just having this recognition was pivotal for me because I allowed myself the grace to understand that I wasn't failing because I was dumb. I was failing because of technical missteps, not giving the things that I had chosen enough time to actually work. I also learned after a few years in the game, something that you might not want to hear, but that's proven true for me over and over. You can't compress what takes 5 years into 5 weeks. I realized I'd been trying to. I was being sold on offers that promised ridiculous results, and I wanted to believe, I wanted to bite. So I did. And the honest truth is that I lost probably $10,000 to $12,000 in a single year buying these 0 to 50K 90-day programs, but nothing ever changed. And it wasn't even because the programs that I was buying were bad. It's because I believed a false premise. It wasn't that I couldn't get there. It's that I was trying to rush results. I was trying to put on a facade, and I wasn't being congruent with myself. So like this stagnation early in my career really made me mad, but it gave me an opportunity as well to start developing some meaning around it. And in my search for meaning, I naturally just started to find these common principles that I could put into a framework to actually guide how I made decisions in my life. And I couldn't have done that without the missteps. So what I thought would be interesting to do is to lay out that framework here, honestly, as much for myself as for you. And so the way that I think about this is kind of starting with broad, high-level topics and then applying those to real-life scenarios. And so I think you'll see what I mean. Let me just go ahead and get into it. And so I basically have five vertices that I'm always thinking about these days when making decisions, right? And so those are risk versus reward, short-term versus long-term, micro versus macro, pain versus pleasure, and local versus non-local. So here's how I think about each. Risk versus reward. So I grew up in a more conservative household. I was passively programmed, I would say, to have a bias to protect and preserve, not to move and multiply. This was an underlying unspoken mentality, not one that was forced upon me. It's just how my parents are. They don't take risks and they're at a point in their life where they don't need to, which I understand. I also realized that I'm not wired that way at all. And that's also probably a byproduct of where I'm at in my life. Single, unmarried, no kids, no student loans, big dreams, and very little to lose. So just throwing that out there for context as well, because context matters with this particular decisional dimension. As a blanket statement, if you want to live an unbelievable life, not a believable one, you have to normalize risk-taking. You have to take risks that others aren't taking, especially on hidden gems or investments with potential for outsized payoffs. And you have to be willing to lose so that you can win big. As a general rule of thumb here, you should determine the probability of success, of failure, which to weigh more based on the variables, so basically adjusted return, and then make the call in the given situation. Pull the trigger or walk away. Other principles here. Do not let big promises of massive upside sway you emotionally. Make everything a math equation. If there's an acceptable cap on the downside, you can weigh the upside a bit more favorably. If there's no ceiling on the upside and the risk is both well understood and acceptable, take action. If the downside risk is ruinous or unacceptable for whatever reason, do not take action despite the upside. If you're on a trajectory toward inevitable ruin, preserve what you have unless and until you find that one thing that can change it all in a single shot. If the worst case scenario is inconsequential, you have no risk. Act now. Now, if you're naturally risk averse, ask yourself whether you might be missing out on legitimate opportunities to level up by being too conservative. If you're overly risk tolerant, ask how your continued exposure and big bets could impact what you have if left unchecked. So that's risk versus reward, right? Make it a math problem, recognize your circumstances, and understand that to do truly remarkable things, you'll have to be willing to put all your cards on the table at some point. Okay, short-term versus long-term. If I told you that you could eat your favorite dessert every single day from now until the day that you die, but that you die at 75, or that you could only eat it once every 2 weeks, but that you'd live to 105, which would you choose? This is the short-term versus long-term conundrum. And so here, it really just comes down to which of these two axes you value most, both now and long-term. So if you over-index on living in the moment, you know, nothing's guaranteed for tomorrow, and all that matters is right now, then make your decisions to optimize your life now. Go on the expensive vacation. Splurge at the mall. Indulge in the things that bring you pleasure in the moment. What you're sacrificing is a potential payoff down the road in order to live and experience life in a certain way right now. Now, the short-term, long-term discussion is intimately related to the point we were just talking about with risk. If you're like me, then you're willing to take calculated risks in the present for the potential of a bigger payoff down the line. So I think this one is really a balancing game, right? Knowing what matters to you now, knowing what's important to you in the future, and then being able to make the right judgment call on both macro and micro decisions that have the potential to affect both of those moments in time. And that kind of leads into the next point, micro versus macro. Whereas when I was younger, I always made decisions based on what I wanted in the present. I wasn't lining up my decisions directionally. I was just kind of focused on what I could see in the headlights right in front of me. I wasn't thinking about the end destination. But I would say now I'm much more sort of living for the future, skewing my decisions toward a better future. And so every micro decision that I make, I ask one central question. Is this helping me to achieve my long-term vision? If the answer is it isn't, then I know it's either the wrong kind of work or a vice that I need to use in extreme moderation because it's just zero sum in terms of what I want to achieve. I also think about what success means here, not conceptually, like practically. As I went through my career and awakened more deeply, I realized that success comes to those who can string together smaller units of time, days, tied to a defined long-tail destination, usually measured in decades. If you have a vision of where you want to be in 10 years, then of course the delta is what must happen between now and then. To get there, it's like putting together this gigantic jigsaw puzzle, but working backwards. You have to make sure that you're correctly divvying up each derivative unit, years, months, weeks, days, and hours for maximum output in alignment with that vision. So how will what you do today move the needle tomorrow and next week and set you up to be a few spots ahead next year at the same time? You can deceive yourself into believing that you're being productive, but is that production tied to results that matter or a known destination? So I realized that I had to learn how to consistently stack one day's work upon the preceding day in pursuit of a goal, and that compounding, consistency, and continued progress would eventually lead to an inflection point where a massive shift could be activated if I worked long enough in the right direction. All right, the next dimension, pain versus pleasure. The crux of the entrepreneurial game is really this. To what extent are you willing to endure definite short-term pain for possible long-term payoff? Life is hard, right? I didn't want to accept that for the first 25 years of my life. I wanted life to be smooth, effortless, easy. I didn't understand that life is inherently hard and painful. What I needed to learn how to do was to feel the pain when I came up against it as a version of pleasure. They're two sides of the same coin. But in terms of decision making, the question to be asked is basically, how much pain or discomfort can you endure for some known or often unknown benefit? And part B, how will I react to pain when it shows its face? I also enjoy training myself to endure pain. If I can do my cold plunges and my 10-mile runs and that extra rep at the gym, if I can do these things and survive, then there's nothing in a boardroom or the business world that can beat me. So you have to use pain as a trainer, as a coach. You can actually seek it out and leverage it, like I said, as a form of pleasure, because enduring and surviving pain is basically an investment in your future self. Things will break often. That's life, but it's how those situations shape you that matters. So when making decisions, I try to factor out the potential for pain. I assume that I'll be able to take whatever pain might come. And I don't need pleasure. I used to think that I did, almost like a reprieve or something that I'd earned from a long week's work. But now I try to find pleasure in my work. And that means, for me, getting into flow state as much as I possibly can. And I realized a couple weeks ago, that's my maximum pleasure. If I'm awake, my job is to be working. And then lastly is basically local versus non-local impact of the decision. So what are the side effects, ripple effects, and possible butterfly effects, as far as I can imagine, from the decision in front of me? If there's a reasonable chance of the outcome impacting anyone else besides me, I'll err on the side of caution when making the decision. If the extent of damages, if things go wrong, is limited to just me, I'll be more selfish with the decision. I think one of the big issues in the world today, or at least in the past, has been people making decisions irrespective of the impact of that decision on others. The old exploitative, expansionist capitalist system is being replaced as we speak by a new kind of game called conscious capitalism. And in this new dynamic, customers, colleagues, and audiences will expect that those who they do business with are caring and considerate of the world at large. So when I'm thinking about decisions in this context, the question that I'm asking is, how is what I'm working on or thinking about doing going to benefit the world? What's the potential impact of this decision on other people? What's the risk to others? What's the benefit to others? And for me, considering this point goes beyond just like a mental exercise or thinking about it because it's the right thing to do. It's totally reshaped my sense of fulfillment and meaning. And now I skew towards decisions that help me contribute to the world at large. So if what I'm working on doesn't have potential to touch other people, it's actually not as enjoyable or fulfilling for me. Fundamentally, I think part of the purpose of life is to enrich the lives of others. So if we can have that mentality always on in the background as like a guiding compass, then it'll affect how we make decisions on what to do in our lives and can serve as a gut check as well if we find ourselves acting in selfish ways. Now, sometimes you have to be selfish, right? I'll always put on my own oxygen mask before trying to help others, right? Because what happens if you're at 50% and you go out and try to serve others who need help just as much as you do? You won't be effective and you won't be serving them in the way that they deserve. So I'd rather wait, get myself in the right position to be able to have enough strength or stamina or leverage to actually help in the way that's needed and that will actually make a difference than to try to force it if I'm not at 100% myself. This is both selfless and selfish at the same time. And sometimes that mentality is needed if you are to make the impact that you're capable of providing. So in general, this is how I think about local versus non-local effects. Prioritizing myself, considering others, and ultimately understanding that the prosperity of the world is the agenda of nature, the planet, and the universe at large, right? It's always optimizing for the system over the individual. So if we can match that, if we can match our heartbeat to that of the universe, we're just going to be more abundant, we're going to be in flow, and we're going to be happier in the process. So that about wraps it up. I know that this video went really deep, but I hope that that depth and detail helped you in some way to reframe or reconsider how you make decisions in the world. For me, centering my thinking and my behavioral processes around these five pillars has served me well. Yours might also be different, which is totally fine. I went ahead and summarized this framework in the description. If you want to copy and paste it, please subscribe to the channel. If you liked this video, turn on post notifications and hey, reach out to me if you have any questions on any of this. I'm here for you unconditionally, would love to connect, and please know that I've got your back. All right, later.
That is it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. My book, Content Capitalist, is now on sale. You can visit my website, michaelbecker.org, to grab your copy. There's also a link in the description. And if you'd like to learn more about what me and my team at Neocore are building, you can visit our website, neocore.co. You can learn more there and join the waitlist for when we launch later this year.